This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
We're going to start with Claire Kremen, director of the Berkeley Food Institute and professor of environmental science, policy, and management. Her current research focuses on exploring the ecological, social, and economic benefits and cost barriers to adoption of a diversified farming systems and on restoring pollination and pest control services in intensively farmed landscapes using both predictive modeling and field studies. So please welcome Claire. Welcome.
Well, thank you so much to the organizers of the conference and the Philomathia Foundation for organizing this great event. In the interest of full disclosure, I will say that I am also an optimist, although unlike Bill Collins, I don't have a dog. But the optimism might be why I chose to come up with such an aspirational title for my talk. And I do want to emphasize that I want to talk about climate change in relationship not just to agriculture, but to the food system. The food system being not just the production of food, but also the distribution, processing, and consumption of food. So since the 1960, we've had the Green Revolution, a tremendous success in terms of production of numbers of calories, which has actually more than doubled and has outstripped the population increases that have occurred around the same time. And so today we produce actually more food than we even need to feed the global population, at least in terms of calories. However, we still, of course, have many people, around a billion, chronically hungry, and we have even more that suffer not just from hunger but from micronutrient deficiencies, and we have a growing problem with obesity. And unfortunately, often these people that are experiencing obesity may also be subject to micronutrient deficiencies because it's really a quality of food issue, not simply a quantity of food issue. And then 30 to 40% of the food that we produce each year is actually wasted. So in many ways, our food system is failing us. When we think about the environmental implications of the way that we produce food, I'll just go through a few slides rapidly. I'm sure that most of you know these things. But of course, soils are fundamental to production and agriculture. And with tillage practices, we now know that we're actually mining the soils. We actually erode them 10 to 100 times faster than they can be naturally regenerated. In addition, we have loss of soil organic matter and fertility in many of our soils in which we are simply replacing the nutrients through chemical fertilizer but not replacing the soil organic matter, and that affects 17% of vegetated lands. And as was spoken about in the earlier session, groundwater pumping can be responsible for salinization, which is affecting 20% of irrigated lands. Agriculture is a huge has huge impacts on most environmental issues. So its contribution to climate change is enormous. It's actually bigger than any other sector, including manufacturing. And this comes from deforestation, a principal cause, such as this oil palm plantation in Southeast Asia, from livestock production, methane emissions, and from the uses of nitrogen fertilizer, which releases nitrous oxides. And then biodiversity loss. Agriculture, again, is a major culprit in biodiversity loss. For one thing, agriculture already occupies 40% of the ice-free terrestrial surface and so has displaced habitat for many species. And this is ongoing. In more recent years, from 1980 to 2000, the most important cause of primary forest destruction in tropical forests was actually agriculture. So 50% of new agricultural land uses are actually have taken place recently on tropical forest lands. And from pollutant effects from agriculture, nitrogen pollution and phosphorus pollution in particular has contributed to the rise and spread of dead zones in the ocean. We now have over 400 oceanic dead zones. And then finally, water use. 70% of the freshwater withdrawals, that is the fresh water that's accessible for agriculture. I'm sorry, for water use. 70% of that is already used for agriculture. And we know that water use in many cases is unsustainable. 14% of rivers running into oceans run dry from excessive withdrawals. And a large number of people live in regions that experience at least 1 month of 100% water scarcity. In other words, places where water use is greater than water renewal. And of course, we have population increases looming. Malcolm is going to talk about that more. And this will put future stresses on the food that we need to produce. In addition, we have changing consumption patterns. And so it's estimated that by 2050, we'll actually have to double food production relative to current levels to meet the growing population and, in particular, the changing demands due to increased affluence. And all of this we're going to have to take care of under the face of climate change. The lack of sustainability that we have in our agricultural system makes agriculture that much more vulnerable to climate change. We've already heard quite a bit about the kinds of things that climate change is going to bring, so I don't want to go over those. We've also heard about some of the vulnerability that agriculture will specifically have towards climate change, in particular with warmer temperatures, with higher nighttime temperatures, as Max talked about in rice, lower winter chill hours, less snowpack, things like that. We can have decreased yields for some crops. Particularly in low latitudes and in seasonally dry regions. We could have drier or wetter conditions depending on where we are. Certainly, we'll have an increased frequency and severity of extreme events, which is perhaps the most important thing. There may be some positive aspects in some parts of the world and certainly negative aspects in many parts of the world. So all of the type of effect that will happen is certainly going to be very dependent on local conditions and also on the crop type that is being utilized, in addition to which, what kinds of farming practices are already being in place and what sort of adaptation measures people are taking. So the outcomes are highly uncertain, but it's just one more factor that we need to take into account. So what would it take to create a climate-resilient food system? Well, I kind of want to step back from that question and ask a broader question. What would it take to create a resilient and sustainable food system in general? Because climate change is one environmental shock, but there are other potential environmental shocks that we are facing, as well as social factors and social shocks. So we really need to think about creating a generally resistant and sustainable food system. And I think that we need to do two major things. We need, obviously, to reduce stresses on the resource base, on land, soil, water, energy, biotic, and human resources. And we also need to think about the social side. So creating social sustainability as well as environmental sustainability. We need to support the right to sufficient, safe, and nutritious food for all. And I think that there's four principal components that could go towards creating this more resilient and sustainable food system. In the interest of time, I'm only going to focus on the first two. The first one being regenerate rather than replace ecosystem services within agriculture. And the second general principle being support small-scale farmers. And you can see the relationship of those two components to the two main bullet items at the top. It's also important that we reduce meat and dairy production and consumption because currently much of the land surface and much of the calories produced are going towards actually producing feed for livestock. About 36% of the calories that we produce go to feed livestock, and only of that, only 4% is actually returned as human feed due to the quite large inefficiencies of feed conversion from grains into meat production. And we also need to reduce food waste. As mentioned earlier, we have 30 to 40% of our food wasted. So all of these forms of waste mean that we're wasting the land, the soil, the water, the energy, and the biotic and human resources that are going in to produce that food that's not actually arriving on the plate or that is suffering from inefficiencies. I'm not going to talk about these last two bullet items, though, because I think that they really follow from the first two. So I want to talk about the this concept of regenerating rather than replacing ecosystem services. And so in a diversified farming system, what a diversified farming system does is to support underlying genetic to support underlying biodiversity from the genetic through to the ecosystem scale. And it does this through a set of practices that you see in these different colors up here. I think I do have a pointer maybe. So it does this through different practices operating at different spatial and temporal scales. And these different practices can actually produce the key inputs that are needed in agriculture, the nutrients, the water, the soil fertility, the pest control, and the pollination. So just to go through an example, for example, at the plot scale or within fields, the use of compost, for example, can provide nutrients. It can store waters in soils. It can aid with soil fertility. Intercropping can aid the production of or support natural enemies that provide pest control. It can support native pollinators that provide pollination services. So when we look at all of these different techniques, we see that there's a synergistic network of supports between these kinds of practices and the regeneration of these key inputs to agriculture by supporting the underlying agrobiodiversity. But what happens when we change from a diversified farming system whose goal is to produce food, but also to support these underlying ecosystem services through supporting the agrobiodiversity? What happens when we change to a monoculture landscape? Well, in that case, then this linkage between the farming practices themselves and the production of these services in the agroecosystem is broken. And so instead, we have to actually replace these ecosystem services with inputs, which we get from off of the farm. So we replace them with chemical fertilizers, for example. We replace them with groundwater pumping, which we heard about earlier, and the problems that that can engender, and irrigation. We replace them with pesticides, and for pollination, we replace it with managed honeybees. And in so doing, we are able to produce a great deal of food. This is clear. The Green Revolution has been very successful in producing a great deal of food. However, it's also clear that we produce many externalities, many environmental ills that we weren't aiming for, and of which I've discussed a few of them already. So, well, how do these more diversified farming systems stack up against our conventional systems that have replaced ecosystem services with chemical, with chemically intensive farming? I think my slide might be just a little bit messed up here, but let me just explain what this is. I'm going to go through a study that I conducted recently with Albie Miles, in which we reviewed the quantitative evidence through meta-analyses that have been conducted by other scientists on a number of key ecosystem services, comparing diversified farming systems with these conventional monoculture systems. And we also included, when no quantitative meta-analysis was available, we looked at long-term studies, so studies that took place in a place greater than 7 years, or regional studies with a great deal of spatial replication. And so on these graphs here, what you'll see, this S here is supposed to be over here. So what that means is strong evidence, or weak evidence, or equivocal in support of the diversified farming system having a very positive effect on the ecosystem service in question. So for biophysical indicators, one of the most important is soil organic matter, and there it is very clear that diversified farming systems and organic systems do a wonderful job at protecting soil organic matter and maintaining soil organic matter in the soils. I'm not going to go through all of these in detail because I have a few more to throw up, but I want you to get the general picture that for quite a large number of these services, we have strong evidence for the value of the diversified farming system in promoting the service. In some cases, we have weak positive evidence, and in a few cases, there is not enough studies, or it's equivocal. And the other one that I really want to draw your attention to are climate change. I'm going to go into some more details on these. We have both mitigation components, so for example, carbon sequestration and reduced energy use. Again, very strong support that diversified farming systems do better at storing more carbon and at using less energy. So positive climate effects there on the mitigation side. And then on the adaptation side, the resilience to drought and the resilience to hurricane extreme events, in other words, that we've heard quite a bit about earlier today. And I'm going to go into some interesting examples of these right now. So I want to visit the Rodale Trial, which is an experimental farm back east. And they've done a number of long-term studies. In this long-term study, the data presented here comes from 1985 to 1999. And what they did is they compared a conventional, which is indicated as CNV, corn-soy rotation, typical of much of the Midwest, where mineral fertilizers and pesticides were applied to provide soil fertility and control pests, against two or different types of organic management systems, one of which had a three-year rotation, corn, soy, and wheat, and then it provided nitrogen fertilizer using legume cover crops instead of fertilizing with synthetic fertilizers, and of course it's an organic system. And another organic system, which is a complex rotation, I believe it was a five-year rotation mimicking livestock integration by integrating manure fertilizer. And what the first point is that in terms of the yields between these three different systems for corn, there were no significant differences in yield across all the years studied. But what's really, and that's shown here actually by this red line, this would be the baseline yield across all the studies. But what's important is that out of 5 years in which droughts were recorded, in four of those years, the organic systems, one or both of the organic systems, did significantly better than the conventional systems. In 1 year, there was a catastrophic drought. This was in 1999. You can see that actually up here in 1995. Here's the organic side and the conventional side for the corn part of the rotation. So there was a catastrophic drought in 1999, which dramatically affected yields of all of the systems. But again, the one of the organic systems did better than the conventional system. The other didn't do so well due to other issues. But what's interesting also is that in the same really dramatic year, it happened that there was this drought. Here's normal rainfall here. Here's the amount of rainfall throughout the summer. And then in September, there was an exceptional rainfall event, so much more than usual. And they were monitoring water harvesting as well, water capture. And what they found was that the water capture in that month, in September, was doubled, actually, in the organic treatments relative to the conventional treatment. So during this ending of the drought, when the water really came on an extreme event, the organic systems were able to actually capture that water. And the difference is really because the soils are so different. The organic soils have much more organic matter in them and are able to capture that water. And that's critical because this morning we heard more about blue water, about irrigation water and groundwater, so surface and groundwater. But there's another type of water that's incredibly important in agriculture, and that we refer to as green water. That's the water, the plant accessible water in soils originating from precipitation. And that's actually a large component of global annual flows, 60% of global annual flows. And it also represents a very large proportion of the amount of water that's consumed by agriculture, 90%, because so much of agriculture is rain-fed. The expanse of agriculture, a lot of it is rain-fed, and even the irrigated agricultural systems are also benefiting from rains. So I want to just go now to an anecdote, and I got this from Tom Philpott, who's a food and agriculture writer, wonderful writer, and he wrote about this fellow named David Brandt, who is farming in Ohio, and there he is, a picture of him. And he's actually doing a farming system that's quite similar to the Rodale trial with a couple of key differences. It's a corn, soy, wheat rotation, whereas most of the people in Ohio and in the Midwest who are growing corn and soy are just doing the corn-soy rotation. So it's a slightly more complex rotation. And in the off-season, he plants a diverse cover crop that could have as many as 14 species. Some of these will be nitrogen-fixing. But he's not an organic farmer. He will use pesticides. He will use synthetic fertilizers when he needs to. The other key thing is that this system is no-till. So he's never tilling the soil. He's just planting, drilling the corn seeds or the soy seeds into the residues from the cover crop. And that's really important. So here I'll just quote directly from Tom's article, his recent article. We start in Brant's field where we encounter waist-high, deep green corn plants basking in the afternoon heat. A mat of old leaves and stems covers the soil, remnants of the winter cover crops that have kept the field devoid of weeds. At Brant's urging, we scour the ground for what he calls haystacks, little clusters of dead, straw-like plant residue bunched up by earthworms. Sure enough, the stacks are everywhere. Brant scoops one up, along with a fistful of black dirt. Then he directs our gaze onto the ground where he just scooped the sample. He points out a pencil-sized hole going deep into the soil, a kind of worm throughway that invites water to stream down. Then we cross the street to the neighbor's field. Here the corn plants look similar to Brant's, if a little more scraggly, but the soil couldn't be more different. The ground, unmarked by haystacks and mostly bare of plant residue altogether, seems seized up into a moist, muddy crust, but the dirt just below the surface is almost dry. Brant points to a pattern of ruts in the ground cut by the water that failed to absorb and gushed away. Brant's land managed to trap the previous night's rain for whatever the summer brings. His neighbors lost not just the precious water, but untold chemical inputs that it carried away. And this is important because, of course, in 2012, we had a killer drought that caused a devastation for many farmers. But interestingly, on Brant's field, he had a normal harvest. So he had stored a lot of water in the soil and was able to, he had the resilience that it took to weather this drought. And then returning to some data, in Idaho, on another experimental farm, they've also conducted a long-term study. Again, looking at not exactly the same, but similar kinds of comparisons. And here, again, comparing the conventional system, the typical two-year corn soy with herbicides and nitrogen fertilizer, against mimicking livestock integration, either a 3 or a 4 year corn soy rotation followed by small grain legume mix, again, fixing nitrogen and manure. So they don't actually have the cows in here, but they're mimicking a system that would integrate livestock. Again, these are not organic necessarily. They would use nitrogen fertilizer and herbicide on an as-needed basis, which is important. And what they did is they studied this over time, and what they found is that for the soybean yield and the maize yield, they actually found a slightly increased yields for the two organic systems that they looked at. It's actually significant. But the most important thing is profits are the same between the two systems. Labor was higher in the organic systems, but the use of input, synthetic nitrogen input and herbicide, was much, much less for the organic systems. And so it all balanced out: a little bit greater yield, less inputs, a little bit more labor costs, profits actually equalized between all three. And profit, in the end, is the bottom line for a grower in determining what they're going to, how they're going to farm. The other important thing, though, is that by the end, after a couple of years of the study, the organic treatments, I'm sorry, I shouldn't be calling them organic because they're not, the longer crop rotation diversified treatments no longer needed to use herbicides to control weeds. All of the different systems managed to control weeds to a similar level, but the conventional system used it, controlled it by using a lot of herbicides, and the other systems controlled it through these rotations. So they have a lot less environmental impacts by so doing. Also, resistance and resilience to hurricanes. I'm not going to go over this slide in detail, but after Hurricane Mitch, there was a study conducted looking at diversified farms versus conventional farms, and what they found was much fewer impacts in these diversified farms. I'm sorry you can't see this slide. It's a little bit too dark here, but here is a big, huge landslide. A lot more landslides, a lot more economic impacts when farms were not diversified. And so one concern, though, is that with these more diversified systems, it's often thought that there's going to be a yield trade-off. So in other words, in the intensive systems, there'll be plenty of crop production, but not too many other ecosystem services provided. In fact, quite a few ecosystem disservices or externalities. But in these diversified farming systems, there'll be lower crop production while some ecosystem services are also provided. That has definitely been a concern, although it's not what we saw in the last example that I just showed you. So the question is there a yield gap? This is some data from from a study that my lab recently conducted. And what we did was ask the question, comparing organic agriculture with conventional agriculture, using organic agriculture as a proxy for diversified farming systems, and ask the question, is there a yield gap? And indeed, there is a yield gap. It's about 14%. So this number here is about at 0.86. Organic production produces a little bit less crop for crop over many studies and many different crops than conventional does. But really, when you think about it, that is not a very large difference. And it's particularly a small difference when you think about the amount of research and development investment that has occurred in industrialized agriculture, particularly since the Green Revolution, but actually continuing to this day. And comparable investment in organic or sustainable agriculture has been very, very small, particularly when you think not only of the public sector, but also the private sector investment. And I'll skip that point because I'm beginning to run out of time. But anyway, the gap is quite small when you consider the sort of the background or the framing. So I want to go on to my second major point, that it's really important that we think not just about the actual farming methods, but supporting the small-scale farmers themselves. Smallholders are critical to our food supply. They produce 50 to 70%, estimates vary, of the world's food. About 50% of these smallholders use diversified, or another term used is agroecological methods. This represents a lot of people, 2.6 billion people, and 85% of all the farms. But paradoxically, these same people are often those who might be hungry or malnourished. And furthermore, smallholders control less and less of the land base, and mean farm size is actually decreasing in many places. So, for example, in Ecuador, the smallholders represent 43% of farmers, but only have 2% of the land. And in India, mean farm size has declined from 2.3 to 1.6 hectares on average over the period 1970 to 1990. Smallholders are increasingly squeezed by consolidated agribusiness corporations that both control access to seeds and to conventional inputs. And some of these same corporations also purchase the commodities. And this diagram here shows, for example, chemical companies like Monsanto or DuPont and their relationship to the seed industry. So many of the chemical companies have actually absorbed some of these seed companies. They're also squeezed by international trade agreements and national policies that favor corporate agribusiness. And increasingly, the phenomenon of land grabs that displace smallholders from their lands. So an encouraging counter to these problems is the Right to Food movement. We're fortunate at the Berkeley Food Institute to have Olivier DeShuter, on which this slide is mostly based, as a visiting professor at the Berkeley Food Institute. He is the special rapporteur to the United Nations on the Right to Food. So the Right to Food movement expresses an increasing recognition of the importance of a legal and policy framework grounded in the right to food, which reflects a growing understanding that hunger is not simply a problem of supply and demand, but primarily a problem of lack of access. based on his work, 25 countries now explicitly stipulate the right to food in their constitutions. Other countries include this in state policies. The right to food movement is comprised of governments, human rights institutions, and civil society or social movements, which I'll get onto in the next slide. The right to food primarily aims to guarantee to each person, individually or as part of a group, permanent and secure access to diets that are adequate from the nutritional point of view, sustainably produced, and culturally acceptable. As such, depending on the population concerned, the right to food is closely related to the right of access to resources such as land, water, food, forests, and seeds that are essential to those who produce food for their own consumption. And the overall goal here is to address the root causes of hunger and malnutrition with the legal backing provided by this international and national laws, and to move away from food aid towards self-sufficiency. And interestingly, the right to food movement, which is a very top-level program, is there's also the food sovereignty movement, which is really a grassroots program. It's a global people's coalition seeking radical change to global food systems. The definition of food sovereignty by the food sovereignty movement in their declaration is people's right to healthy and culturally appropriate food produced through ecologically sound and sustainable methods, and their right to define their own food and agricultural systems. Critically, it puts those who produce, distribute, and consume food at the heart of food systems and policies, rather than the demands of markets and corporations. And the food sovereignty movement has taken on many different actions. Farmer-to-farmer training in agroecology around the world has been very successful, also challenging transnational corporations and the World Trade Organization, fighting climate change, seeking land reform, and others. And I think that we're actually at a historical opportunity for the transformation of our food system to one that is more sustainable, more just, more resilient to climate change, because we have this international top-down kind of effort, the global governance of the right to food movement, and then we also have this grassroots movement, the global food sovereignty movement, a bottom-up type of movement. And interestingly, one of the things that kind of links them together is the diversified farming systems or agroecological approach, which is something that the global, that the right to food movement sees as a way of advocating for self-sufficiency, whereas from the food sovereignty perspective, it's a way of actually implementing or achieving the goals of food sovereignty. But of course, there are huge obstacles to actually having this kind of transformation that would produce a more sustainable and resilient and more just system. And that's where the Berkeley Food Institute comes in. We're very sensitive to the many obstacles that there are out there. The Berkeley Food Institute began just about a year ago, and our goal is to aid the transformation of the food system towards one that is more diverse, more just, more resilient, and more healthy for people globally. And to do so, we recognize the need to include people at UC Berkeley from many different components of UC Berkeley. So the College of Natural Resources, the Goldman School of Public Policy, the School of Public Health, the Graduate School of Journalism, and Berkeley Law have all participated very actively and very strongly in creating the Berkeley Food Institute, along with students and the community. I see sort of three main areas of research emerging, but there will probably certainly be many more. This diversified or agroecological farming systems, the adaptation of agriculture to climate change, and social movements and innovations with the potential to transform the current food system are all interesting areas of research. In addition to which, we're very interested in education, communication, and policy. Please take a look at our website, food.berkeley.edu. And I want to thank you for your time. And I think I'm probably out of time, so.
Thank you, Claire. The right to food movement is an interesting follow-on to the right to water movement, which achieved some success recently at the United Nations. That slide there about food waste, I just made me think of Jonathan Bloom's book, excellent book, American Wasteland, if you haven't seen that, about food waste. Next, I'd like to introduce assistant professor at the Goldman School, Solomon Xiang, who focuses on how policy can encourage economic development while managing global climate change, how natural disasters impact societies, and the effectiveness of policy responses, and how environmental conditions influence social instability and violence.
Great. Thank you very much for this opportunity. So far today, we've spoken a lot about how we are affecting our environment. And what I want to talk to you about now is a lot of emerging work where we're trying to understand better how the environment affects us back in return. So about a year ago, I started this project with two other members of UC Berkeley, Marshall Burke and Ted Miguel, where we were asked to go out and examine to what extent is there quantitative or statistical evidence that climatic conditions affect human conflict or different types of social instability. Now, there are many reasons why climatic conditions might affect instability. A lot of ideas have been put out there by theorists. If you look through history, there's a lot of stories that can be told. I won't go through all of them, but sort of some of the salient arguments are, for example, that climatic conditions can adversely affect economic conditions. And when the economy deteriorates, people's incentive to participate in the productive economy obviously declines. And so the relative incentive to participate in other types of extractive actions, maybe joining a rebel group that promises some likelihood of a payout if you successfully take over the government, might rise. Okay, so there's actually some labor market dynamics here that where the climate can influence people's willingness to participate in non-productive activities, things that might lead to conflict. But there's other ideas out there as well. For example, related to what we just saw, it's thought that food price spikes might increase population's willingness to sort of take to the streets. There are ideas about how the climate can affect underlying inequality within a society, and that can lead to social strife. And there's other arguments about, you know, transportation and logistics and populations migrating to cities very rapidly, creating rapid strains on public resources. And then finally, there's actually a really large literature I'll show you briefly from psychology where we see that people actually change the way they think based on their environmental conditions, and that can in some cases lead to violence. So we were tasked with examining to what extent is there systematic quantitative evidence that there is some sort of linkage between climatic conditions and interpersonal or intergroup conflict. And to sort of do this, my colleagues and I went into the literature and pulled from archaeology, criminology, economics, political science, and we came up with sort of a very rigorous quantitative standard of how studies had to be conducted. And then we were able to recover 60 studies that met this standard. They were coming from all these different fields, and they represent the collective work of almost 200 authors from around the world. And in a few cases, the studies were not quite up to the statistical standards that we had imposed for ourselves. So we actually contacted the authors of the original study, got the data, and reran their analysis, sort of using these more modern techniques. And so just to give you a sense of what we were doing, so to select different studies, which I will show you, the study has to be quantitative and data-based. And importantly, the study has to follow how populations behave over time. Okay, so to get a sense of why we're doing that, one can imagine, first of all, the ideal experiment we would like to do is we'd like to have two planets, and we would like to heat one of them up and keep one of them the same temperature, and we'd like to observe how social conflict changes in those two. Right? So that's a hard experiment to do. In the absence of that experiment, what people have done in some cases is they've gone to different populations around the world, and they've said, well, one population is in a hot climate, and one population is in a cool climate. Do they have different patterns of violence? Now, that's obviously not quite the right approach, because if we were to look at two countries, say Norway and Nigeria, they have very different climates, but they also have very different geographies, very different governments, very different histories, very different politics. So there's too many confounding variables that we can't plausibly control for. So instead, what we do is we go to a single location, and we follow that population over time as the climate varies. And then we observe how that population's behavior varies to reflect those underlying changes in the environment. And the one reason we do that is that, well, the main reason we do that is so that the population serves as the control and the treatment group for itself at different moments in time. And in that, through that setup, we know that we're accounting for the geography and the politics and the history, because those things are unchanged in this sample. So that's the sort of standard that all these studies have to follow. They have to follow a population. And we were able to obtain basically roughly a dozen studies that looked through deep history. There's a small number of actual experiments where they put people in a laboratory and change their conditions and see how they respond. And then the vast bulk of the studies are these observational studies that look at historical populations and their behavior. Just to give you a sense, this is the first study that really takes a broad look at different types of human conflict. So at all different scales of sort of the conflict spectrum, we go from interpersonal violence, things like crime on the street and domestic violence, to intergroup conflict. These are things like racial riots or civil conflicts, all the way up to full-scale institutional breakdown and the collapse of sort of historical populations. Now, to give you a sense of how the literature stands to date, each horizontal bar on this graph represents a different study that we were examining. And on the vertical axis, you can see the different regional coverage of these different studies. And on the x-axis, you can see the sample of years that the study was examining. Now, that x-axis is in a log scale. So on the left-hand side, it goes all the way from 8,000 BC up to the present day. And one thing we see is that in the modern world, we have studies from all around, from every continent. So we have a really large number of studies from Africa, but we also do have studies from the Americas as well as Eurasia. And then we have a large number of studies in the modern era that are fully global in their coverage. I want to show you a few of the studies just to give you a sense of what the evidence, the current state of the evidence is. So this was a famous study where they wanted to understand whether or not the climate played a role in the collapse of the Akkadian Empire. So the Akkadian Empire was one of the earliest empires. It occupied what is modern-day Syria. And so what you see here is the orange bar is sort of when we know that the Akkadian Empire collapsed. And the line is showing you a reconstruction of how wet it was in the region based on cores from the bottom of the Sea of Oman just off the coast. And so by pulling up mud from the bottom of the ocean, we can reconstruct what was rainfall like over land, because when there's more rainfall over land, less dust blows over the ocean and settles to the bottom. Okay, so we reconstruct and we found, well, not our team, this Cullen team found that the collapse of the Akkadian Empire was coincident with a massive drying event in the Arabian Peninsula. Now, this is only one study. What we were able to do is actually point out that there are studies from around the world and throughout history where similarly structured evidence exists. Okay, so each vertical orange bar represents a period of either major social conflict, social upheaval. For example, in the middle panel, it was by reconstructing basically the strength of the monsoon in China, it was pointed out that almost all Chinese dynasties collapsed during dry periods, sustained dry periods, and that no new Chinese dynasty was able to consolidate political power until the climate shifted back to its wetter state. Interestingly, one of the bars on the right, is there a pointer? Is the collapse of the Tang Dynasty, which coincided with the collapse of the Mayan Empire on the opposite side of the Pacific Ocean. And it looks like it was a related climatic event which caused drying on both sides of the Pacific Ocean simultaneously. Now, one can ask whether or not this type of evidence has any relevance to us today. These populations existed many years ago when technology was very different. Populations tended to be poorer than the global average. However, we do point out that some of these populations that we're observing have a resource base or an access to resources that is similar to many populations around the world today. Okay, so if we were to look, for example, at the collapse of the Mayan Empire, we would find some countries in Africa have per capita incomes that are roughly the same, according to current estimates by economic historians. So obviously, populations in Niger or in Chad live in a world where the technological frontier is far beyond these historical populations. But one important question we have to ask ourselves is whether or not they really have access to all those technologies and whether or not their resource base might be more comparable to these historical societies. Shifting gears a little bit, I'll just point you to a couple very interesting sort of experimental psychology studies. So these are studies conducted by psychologists. In the first one, it seems a little bit silly. So what they did is they basically went to a parking lot in Arizona, and on weekends, one of the researchers would go and park a car in a place where there's only one lane and wait until a second car pulled up behind them, and then when the light turned green, they would do nothing. They would just sit, and they would wait for the entire 12-second green light cycle, and the researcher in the bushes would sit there with a stopwatch and time how many seconds out of that 12-second cycle the guy in back was honking his horn. Okay, and the result is right here on the. So what you see is on the y-axis, it's the time spent hawking. On the x-axis is a measure of temperature on the day of the experiment. They did this every weekend throughout the summer in Phoenix, and what we saw is that individuals tended to behave more aggressively to a complete stranger on hotter days. Now, in a slightly more serious example, a research group in the Netherlands took police trainees and placed them in a training exercise in an enclosed room where they were confronted with a video of an assailant approaching them with a crowbar. And they had to make a decision about how to respond. This is actually a standard training exercise for these policemen, but some of the individuals were put in hot treatment and some of them were put in a very comfortable room. And what was observed is that the police officers put in the hot room were more likely to take an aggressive posture and more likely to draw or fire their weapon. Okay, and so this... They were debriefed afterward, and they all took a survey, and the researchers concluded that it seemed like the most likely reason why the researchers, the policemen in the hot treatment were more likely to employ violence was because they actually felt more threatened given the same stimulus. Okay, so they reported feeling like their life was in greater danger than the individuals in the cooler treatment. And so this suggests that there's something very deep and psychological about how we interpret one another's actions, and that those interpretations can be conditioned by our environment. Finally, like I said, the vast bulk of the research is coming from historical observational studies where we have data on what happened to different populations and where that data is matched to sort of social outcome data. So I'll just point out a few so you have a sense of what those studies look like. In a very important 2004 study, my co-author and his colleagues pointed out that civil war in African countries was much more likely in years when rainfall was declining. And at the same time, it was pointed out that the GDP of these countries was also declining in those years. And so they suggested that maybe it was the decline in rainfall that led to a decline in GDP that led to an increased likelihood of civil war in these countries. Now, those researchers, in conjunction with my other co-author, then revisited that study 5 years later, and they actually included information about temperature and found that actually high temperatures were a more important predictor variable, and that high temperatures were actually playing a more significant role in elevating the risk of civil war in these countries. I was not working with these co-authors at the time, but with some of my colleagues at Columbia, we were able to actually extend this work further and point out that the state of the global climate seems to be an important predictor of the rate at risk which civil conflicts around the global tropics are being initiated. And to give you a sense of what that looks like, so the way we were able to do that is we were conditioning the likelihood of conflict on the El Niño Southern Oscillation, which is the dominant mode of the global climate on a year-to-year basis. And so when an El Niño event occurs, what happens is that in the Pacific Ocean, a tremendous amount of thermal energy is released from the ocean into the atmosphere, and then it produces a large equatorial Kelvin wave that propagates through the tropics, leading to warming and drying throughout the tropical band. This lasts for several months and then dissipates towards the end of the year. And so what we did is we tried to identify those locations that were getting hit by that large atmospheric wave propagating around the equator. And here those are marked as sort of the blackish-reddish pixels that are labeled teleconnected. And so what we did is then tried to understand on a year-to-year basis when the Pacific Ocean became warmer and created that large wave, did the tropical band, the red tropical band, generate more civil conflicts? And so what we have here is on the x-axis, we have basically the state of the Pacific Ocean, the equatorial Pacific, and on the y-axis is the risk that a randomly selected country begins a new civil conflict in that year. And what we see is that as we shift from the cooler and wetter La Niña state on the left to the hotter and drier El Niño state on the right, the risk of civil conflict throughout the equatorial band effectively doubles from 3 to 6%. Now, The blue line here is labeled weakly affected. Those are the countries that are too far north or too far south to be hit by that large equatorial wave. So in a sense, that's like our placebo group. And we see they weren't getting hit by this large wave, and we see no signal in terms of the likelihood of civil conflict in these countries. So that's a global result. And I've just plotted here for you those same pixels in green on the top panel and sort of the same response that I was just showing you for the tropical band in the lower panel. That's a global result. But what's been really exciting about this study is that by looking at many different studies from many different researchers, we've been able to point out that there are other studies that looked at just Africa at the country scale. There was an important nested study that looked at pixels just within East Africa. Sorry, going backwards. And then there had actually been another study looking just at Tanzanian villages. And so this map on the left is actually a plot of all the villages just within a single pixel in the second to left plot. And throughout all of these sort of scales of social organization, all of these different spatial scales, when we look at how societies respond to fluctuations in their environment, we tend to see similar patterns. So in general, a shift towards higher temperatures or towards more extreme rainfall events tends to elevate the likelihood of social conflict at all of these different spatial scales. There's actually more examples than just Africa, though. This is not a strictly African phenomenon. So on the left here, I'm showing you a result from sort of pixels within just Kenya. We see that as temperature rises, the likelihood of political and intergroup violence is rising at the local level in Kenya. But it's also observable around the world in other contexts. So, for example, the top middle panel here, we're showing here that sort of the likelihood of farmers to invade one another's property in the Amazon basin rises when when the rainfall is either too high or too low. And those are the types of events that cause a collapse of the farmer's income, basically because crops do so poorly. In India, rainfall losses are associated with an increase in Hindu-Muslim riots at the county level. In the United States, there's very high-resolution data on a variety of different crimes. And what we see is that across basically all counties within the United States, an elevation of temperature leads to higher rates of violent crime in basically a linear fashion, including this. This is a recent study by Ranson, very important. They point out that many different subtypes of crime, including rape, increase with increasing temperature. And then in the last panel, this is a very interesting, amusing, but important study. They actually were examining every at-bat in Major League Baseball in the United States. Sort of an incredible data set. And what they so what happens in baseball is that sometimes the pitcher will hit the batter with the ball. This is a very violent act. And what happens is, you laugh, but these guys are throwing the ball like 100 miles an hour. And so what often happens is that if I hit your batter with the ball, you, when we switch sides, will retaliate and hit my batter with the ball. And so this is a very frequently observed type of exchange, sort of a form of intergroup violence. And what they find is that the likelihood of retaliation, conditional on you hitting my batter, increases dramatically with the temperature on the day of the game. Okay? So this is important because it indicates that there's a tie, a linkage, between interpersonal violence and intergroup violence that can be conditioned on the environmental state. So we can escalate. We have escalation from interpersonal conflicts where I drag in my buddies and they start fighting on my behalf. So we've looked at 60 studies. I haven't shown you all of them, but sort of the take-home messages are we observe associations between climate variables and human conflict across all major regions of the world, across all periods of recorded human history, at all different scales of human organization, at all different spatial scales, and at all different temporal scales. So we actually observe that whether it's an anomalous hour, an anomalous day, an anomalous week, a month, a year, a decade, and in some cases there are studies that have even pointed out that over anomalous centuries, populations are more likely to experience this type of upheaval or different forms of conflict. And so it's not as though slower changes are necessarily easier for populations to adjust to. There are many reasons to think why slow changes are actually harder to adjust to. For example, you use up all your reserves that you've stored to get you through the tough times. To give you a sense of what's going on, so the global relationship that we're sort of able to uncover is something we call U-shaped. So basically, if we have very high rainfall, very low rainfall, those tend to both be very bad for agriculture. And we also observe that those tend to lead to higher incidences of different types of human conflict. Similarly with temperature, if we increase the temperature of a population that's already quite warm, we observe higher rates of conflict at all these different scales. And if we go far enough back in time to where we're in populations that are basically in a cold epoch, in a relatively cold or temperate region, we observe that cold events also tend to increase the likelihood of conflict. But in the modern world, it looks as though most populations are already warm enough that they're on sort of the warm side of that U-shaped relationship. An important part of this study was that we actually also tried to standardize results across many, many different communities. And I will only point this out for a moment, but basically we want to pin down a number. We want, for policy purposes, we want to really get people thinking about what we're willing to pay to avoid climatic change. In order to do that, we need a real precise estimate. So here, what we've done is we've taken all the studies of interpersonal conflict, and we've converted them to units of percentage changes per standard deviation in climate. Okay, and the reason we use standard deviation in climate is because climatic variations tend to be very different at different locations, and so we want to sort of calibrate this based on what the observed variation people expect to see, and we convert it to percentage changes because different types of violence have very different likelihoods of occurring sort of in baseline, so we don't want to use counts. And so what we see is that when looking at interpersonal conflict, a one standard deviation change, which is actually something that's not so uncommon, tends to lead to a roughly 2.5 to 4% increase in interpersonal violence, sort of as our global best guess, but we do get higher estimates as we go to sort of lower income populations. This is when we look at intergroup conflict, there's actually many, many more studies. And what we find is sort of an average and a median estimate in the vicinity of about 12 to 14% per standard deviation, which is actually a much larger change in risk. But it's important to point out that these tend to be, these are much less common events. Civil war, civil conflict are much less common than interpersonal violence. Just for a sense of scale, in the United States alone, on an annual basis, there's roughly 2 million violent crimes. So if we talk about increasing that rate by a few percentage points, that's a large number of individual crimes that we're talking about. So now taking these numbers and thinking about the future, we're hesitant to make sort of very concrete projections because there are many things about society that we expect to change over the next several decades. But what we've done here is we've taken output from sort of a business as usual scenario, and we've scaled it according to the local standard deviation in temperature. And what you see is that around the world, in most inhabited regions, temperatures are expected to increase by 2 to 4 or 4+ standard deviations. And so when held against the backdrop of these results, where you get about roughly a 4 to a 14% increase per standard deviation, this would suggest sort of some very careful thought about the extent to which future climatic variations could produce sort of more human conflict. So our sort of main conclusion is that to date, there's been an explosion of empirical research, and it is remarkably consistent. So for an example, there are 27 modern empirical studies of just looking at the effects of temperature. And of all those 27 studies, all 27 of them suggest that there's a positive association. So higher temperatures lead to more conflict. To get a sense of whether or not that's something that could happen by chance, you could think about flipping a coin 27 times and asking how likely it is that you would get 27 heads in a row. Okay, it's very unlikely. The results for rainfall are slightly less consistent, but they are still strong nonetheless. And importantly, the quantitative magnitude of these effects, the last numbers I was showing you, are sufficiently large that we think that this impact has real policy relevance and is something that we need to consider carefully. Importantly, what we do not conclude is that climate is the only cause of social conflict. Obviously, human conflict is very complex. There are many factors playing a role, and the climate is only one of those. It's a contributing or sometimes amplifying factor, but it's not by any means explaining the vast majority of what we observe in terms of human conflict around the world. And so, you know, in this study, what we've pointed out, there's really strong systematic evidence of a linkage between these two things, A and B, but we still have yet to figure out exactly how they're connected. Okay? None of the statistical studies so far are able to point to any one of those numerous hypotheses I showed you on the first slide. And so moving forward, the main task is going to be to identify what is the particular pathway that's acting here, because we need to understand what the mechanism is if we're going to try to use policy to interfere and reduce these responses, to reduce the effect that that climate has on human conflict, because obviously that's a positive social objective. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Solomon. I'm glad I live in a foggy city. I hope it stays that way. Next, we're going to hear from the elephant in the room. I talked to a lot of people on Climate One Radio, energy experts, environmentalists, et cetera, frequently mention population, and most people run from the question. They don't like to talk about it. It's not their issue. Particularly environmentalists don't like to talk about population. Malcolm Potts is director of the Bixby Center for Population Health and Sustainability and professor of the School of Public Health. He's worked previously at the International Planned Parenthood Federation and worked as the CEO of the Family Health International. So please welcome Malcolm.
So I believe that a great university can do something unique in the face of seemingly insoluble problems. As polymaths, we can ask questions that haven't been asked before. We can gather evidence to make reasonable predictions several decades ahead, and we can seek solutions. We can also cross disciplines, which is what today's meeting is really about. So the elephant in the room, I suggest, is population, and I want to suggest that this elephant is a friend. Among the many variables related to water, climate, and human population may be the one that is most readily addressed. Population growth and water stress, here's our friendly elephant, tracked together. The population dependent upon the Nile will almost double in the next 40 years, and this, I think, could produce some problems. The population of Syria has tripled since 1950. 80% of the cattle died in the 2006 drought. The rural areas that had least access to family planning and large families, the young men migrated to the cities. They looked for employment. They didn't find any, and it was very hot, and they turned to violence. The 9/11 Commission got it right. They described a large, steadily increasing population of young men without any reasonable expectation of suitable or steady employment was a sure prescription for social turbulence. My own work focuses on the Sahel. That's a million square miles of semi-arid region where water shortages, climate change, and population pose an immediate threat. We held a meeting last year bringing together people from the Sahel, and we called it OASIS, Opportunities to Advance Solutions in the Sahel. The emissions that we put out as developed countries, as we heard this morning, damage the developing countries most. In the Sahel, temperatures are predicted to rise by 2 to 3 degrees Celsius by 2050 and a stunning 5 to 8 by the end of the century. Even a few days at a very high temperature can cause crop yields to plummet. This is a graph for corn production, but it's the same for sorghum. Now add the population factor. The population of the Sahel has grown from 30 million in 1950 to over 125 million today, and it could reach a staggering 650 million. That is the median UN projection by the end of the century. Our meeting brought together climatologists, demographers, experts in family planning, agriculture, and national security, and those interested in the well-being and education of girls and young women. Some cross-disciplinary skills, like those gathered here today, help diagnose the problems of the scale and also to create the possibility of solutions. There are evidence-based solutions to many of the things that we see happening in relation to water, climate, and society. Let's go back to the elephant in the room. I think it could be our friend. As Chris Field mentioned this morning, he mentioned sort of population as a given. I want to emphasize that population is a variable open to change in a human rights framework. That is a very, very important conclusion. And the projections that the UN Population Division makes median, high, and low, which I'll give later, are all equally plausible. There's no reason to focus on the median one. It's helpful to look more closely at the variables which do create these population projections. Again, as Chris Fields reminded us, science self-corrects. The common belief is that people have fewer children as they become more educated and richer. We're correcting the paradigm and emphasizing that it's access to family planning, independent of education and economic factors, that appears to be an essential driver of fertility decline. The education of girls is an unfettered good, but it's not a prerequisite for fertility decline. In 2009, the Bixby Center hosted an international meeting on population 2050, and this was published in the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society. I like it because it's volume 364, and they've had one volume since the Royal Society was founded each year. So the consensus of that conference was that family size will fall even among illiterate women living on a dollar a day when voluntary family planning is made available in ways that respect women. Unless women have the information and technology they need to separate sex from childbearing, the default position is a large family. Even here in the US, we keep oral contraceptives on prescription. And that's one example of the many unnecessary and justified barriers that separate women from the information and the technology they need to separate frequent sex from childbearing. Unfortunately, most heterosexual couples do have frequent sex. The American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists endorses the over-the-counter sale of oral contraceptives. The pill is safer than aspirin, yet it remains on prescription. It is an example of an unnecessary and justified barriers. Many women in the Sahel say they never want another child or they don't want another child in the next 2 years, just like their counterparts in this room, but they lack access to modern contraception. I have seen firsthand how rapidly the demographic transition can take place once women are given the means to choose when to have a child. It took the United States of America 58 years, from 1842 to 1900, to go from a total fertility rate, the average number of children, from 6 to 3.5. Thailand, where I've worked, made that transition in 8 years because they had access to modern contraception and safe abortion. If we look at this, where countries like the Philippines or Pakistan, where it's quite difficult to get family planning, the transition from 6 to about 3 children takes perhaps 20 years or more. Here is the most rapid decline in fertility on the history of the planet, and that is the Islamic Republic of Iran, which we associate with very religious, conservative way of life. And so what happened there was that they simply made family planning choices readily available. You could get a vasectomy. You could get the pill. A lot of discussion between the religious leaders, and the Holy Quran does endorse the use of family planning and talks about spacing your children for 2 years by breastfeeding. Some people still think the discussion about population implies coercion. The reality is that family planning is listening to what women want, not telling them what to do. This chart, here's a very rapid, here's the decline in the total fertility rate in China in the red line. Here's the decline in Iran, which is even more rapid from this sort of over 5 to under 3 than it was in China, with no one-child policy, entirely voluntary. This chart tells the whole story. Where family planning is difficult to get, as in the Philippines, the blue bars, where the bishops thwart access to contraception, then rich, educated women, the upper economic quantile, have about 2 children. Where family planning and the poorest have over 5. where family planning is easy to get, as in Bangladesh, which is a country which is poorer, less educated, and has twice the infant mortality rate of the Philippines, then the difference in family size between the highest economic quintile and the lowest, there is a difference, but it's much, much less. That is the power of making family planning available. When the barriers that previously prevented women from making choices about family size are removed, then in my experience, in 50 years of working in family planning, family size always falls. The elephant in the room should be our friend. Voluntary family planning and its potential impact on slowing rapid population growth in a human rights framework is not the only factor influencing the future of water, climate, and society. But changing policies and investing in family planning is a prerequisite for ameliorating the somber problems of global warming, water shortage, conflict, and political instability facing the planet. We need to learn that the pill is mightier than the sword. Melinda Gates got it right when she said the most transformative thing we can do is to give people access to birth control. Family planning is critical to both the mitigation and adaptation to climate change. Half of all pregnancies in the United States are unintended. Averting an unintended pregnancy eliminates a lifetime accumulation of carbon emissions. A federally funded family planning program in California called Family Pact offers contraception to women living below 200% of the poverty line. An evaluation found that Family Pact averts almost 300,000 unintended pregnancies annually by offering poor women voluntary family planning. It not only improves the lives of women and the health of their families, but it reduces the carbon emissions in California by 400 million tons. Perhaps some of the carbon offsets in California should go to family planning. The evidence is impeccable. The trouble is we are so difficult to handle this emotional thing which relates to our genitals. Let's get sensible. Family planning could be one wedge in the many things that we need to do to slow carbon emissions. Family planning can also help countries in the South adapt to climate change. The regions with the highest population growth, which are the red ones here, and the most water scarcity, are also the one with the highest unmet needs for family planning. So the black dots represent countries where there's survey evidence showing that women want to plan their families, but they can't get hold of contraception. And there's a very close alignment between these countries and which countries face water scarcity. Bangladesh faces serious challenges as a result of rising sea levels. But tens of millions of women in Bangladesh now have two children. That won't solve the problem, but I think Bangladesh is more likely to adjust to climate change than Pakistan, where by 2050 there'll be more people squeezed into an area slightly larger than Texas than live in the United States of America. So, and what's going to happen to Pakistan when the Himalayan glaciers no longer exist? Global population has more than tripled in my lifetime, not because women are having more babies, but because more children are surviving to reproduce in the next generation. Tragically, the global effort to reduce infant mortality has not been matched by a similar effort to make family planning readily accessible. Partly as a result of these mistakes, 98% of future population growth will take place in the developing, especially the least developed countries. One trouble is that we're numbed by numbers. We have seen so many bar charts, we are so addicted to PowerPoints, as David Ackerley said, that we no longer realize that these are numbers about breathing, living human beings. There's a report today in the New York Times of 92 people trying to leave Niger because there's so few opportunities, who died of thirst in the desert, and that is upsetting. 30 million people have died from AIDS. That is very great anguish. But how can we think about a world where if we continue business as usual and don't help people slow population growth and we don't slow climate change, then hundreds of millions of children, women and men, could die prematurely. Let's look at these figures in a different way. Not with a bar chart, but a little bit of plastic I cut up in my garage. This is the population of the Sahel in 1950, 30 million. This is the population of the Sahel today, 125 million. This is a population of the Sahel in 40 years' time, and it's going to be very hot. The crops will wither, the cattle will die. This is more people than live in the United States of America, and they're not going to have any food. 70% of the people in the Sahel depend upon crops or animals. Most of them live on less than a dollar a day. There's poor education, lack of political capital. So perhaps these flowers are the ones for people's funerals. But these are giant numbers, and it's so difficult to get our hearts and our minds around them that this is how many people have died in the past 30 years of AIDS. Already 11 million of these people are malnourished. How are we going to feed these people? We're going to have the largest involuntary migration in human history. We will have more conflicts like Darfur. The low variant of the UN is that the world could have 6.2 billion people in 2100. The medium variant, which a lot of climatologists and ecologists use, is 10.1 billion. The high variant is 15.8 billion. The difference between the high and low variants, almost 10 billion, rests on the assumption that women will have an average of half a child above or half a child below the median variant. As an obstetrician, half a child seems to me as a Monty Python ring about it, but I think we all understand what these projections mean. I hope I have presented evidence that policies to make family planning readily available, together with modest investments in training and, where needed, subsidizing the cost of contraceptives, could easily push family size down by half a child. We could have a world of 6.2 billion people. It was Halloween last night. Americans spent more not on candy, not on costumes, but on costumes for their pets on Halloween than this country gives to international family planning. Virtually all ecologists and those committed to feeding the future would agree that a world of almost 16 billion will never happen because death rates would rise due to lack of food and increasing conflict. I believe that the essential question facing all of us in the 21st century is this one. Can we create a sustainable world for our children and grandchildren as consumption, climate change, and population collide? Most biologists agree that we have exceeded, or will shortly exceed, the capacity of the planet to sustain human numbers and human consumption. Some economists and engineers do not see this problem. Bridging this gap is vital. I don't know what that bridge will look like, but I do think that Berkeley may be a better place than any other university to construct such a multidisciplinary connection. Some of my grandchildren could be alive in 2100. Only a university can create the evidence-based scenarios so far ahead. I suggest that Berkeley has the leadership in water, in climate, and in population and family planning, they're a better place than any other university to make these long-term projections. As today's presentations have demonstrated, we're getting pretty good at the process of advancing solutions, whether in water or climate or population, whether in California or halfway across the world in the Sahel. Not all politicians are as far-sighted as the mayor of LA, but there's the academic will, I think, in a university to define and refine the solutions to overarching problems. I'd like to thank the Fana Mathia Foundation for their support. And on behalf of the Bixby Center for Population, Health, and Sustainability, I would like to invite my colleagues in other disciplines to follow up on this meeting and explore the synergy between population, family planning, food security, water security, conflict, and terrorism with a new sense of urgency. Thank you very much.
I have a few questions, but I want to really get to you. So I think we have, do we have microphones here?
Yes.
Oh, we're going to get written questions. Okay. While we're getting written questions, then the first one I had was for Claire, just trying to get a sense of examples where you cited those studies. Are there real-world production examples where organics or the diversified farming system has really operated at large scale?
Well, I think that the one example that I did give you is an example of large scale. The farmer, David Brandt, is a typical farmer, so he's operating at a large scale. I think that when you think about a fully diversified farming system, such as I put up on, you know, as a conceptual framing where we're thinking about diversification from the plot to the field all the way up to the landscape scale, that, you know, an organic system that's very carefully monitoring all those things, having intercropping, polyculture, cover cropping, hedgerows, all of these different elements. I don't know of many examples that are really large scale, but I do know of some examples. Actually, for example, here in California, Full Belly Farm is about 300 to 500 acres. That's a pretty big farm, and they definitely do that. Yeah, I guess I do know an example. Okay. Depends what you mean by large scale.
Right, and that's often a question of can organic scale, can they feed the world? I wanted to ask Solomon about whether the research you've cited has been noted by police and law enforcement, and is there anything that they can do to sort of predict or anticipate when mercury rises? What do the cops do? What does law enforcement do? You know, have they read your studies?
Well, in the wake of our publication, we had a lot of communication with various, law enforcement-related mm-hmm. organizations. But the truth is that a lot of this has been known for some time. So one example is that there's an episode of The Wire about it. So I don't know if I hear that.
You've arrived, yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's an episode where it's a hot day in Baltimore, thank you. And the police commissioner says, you know, people are going to be a little crazy. Everyone be careful today, and they put more cops. So it's not – now, I'm sort of – that's kind of like a joke, but there's – qualitatively, it's also – you know, if you go to Shakespeare, for example. So my co-author Mark Kane pointed out to me that the very first scene in Romeo and Juliet is Mercutio talking with his friends saying, should we go to the bar? And they say, oh, it's a really hot day. If we go to the bar, we're bound to get into a fight. So we shouldn't do it. They end up going to the bar. They end up getting into a fight. And the rest of the story is about this family feud related to that initial fight. So so casual observation has been pretty powerful historically. And so I think this is used, I think, by some individuals in law enforcement as one of their strategies. And I think law enforcement is one place where taking advantage of a lot of big data sets has been widely adopted actually over a decade ago. So they've been.
Question from the audience for Malcolm. There are an increasing number of studies that suggest birth control, oral contraception cause water pollution and have negative effects on fish populations, a food source. How does this fit into your thesis?
To the best of my knowledge, female Homo sapiens, cows, and all female mammals produce a lot of hormones, and they come out in the urine the same way. They may not be quite as persistent, and I think there are people in the room who know more about that. I do know that the Japanese refused to approve oral contraceptives in about 1990 because they said the hormones would come out in the urine and feminize Japanese fish. A few months later, they approved Viagra, and they never said that Viagra would give sexually excited fish in Japanese rivers.
I got nothing on that. Not going to even try. Question for Solomon here about the elaborating more on the stadium violence and that sort of thing, and what, again, what people have done to try to adapt to that statistic in stadium violence.
To date, I don't know about anyone having taken action on that. The study about the baseball violence was actually just a very recent study. It's 2012, so it's a really new finding.
For Claire, on the yield gap between conventional and organic, 14%, you minimize that, but 14% is pretty, anyone talking about profit margins, et cetera, they can make 14%, they'd be very happy with that. So a challenge to saying that, that 14% is pretty significant.
Yeah, I agree. 14% is significant, but my point is that I think that this gap would be easy to reduce to zero, in fact, or to reverse. There hasn't been the kind of research effort into organic systems that there has been into conventional systems. There's been just a paltry amount of research and a huge amount of investment on conventional systems. So if we were to put that kind of research into optimizing organic systems, and I think we could easily combat that. There's a couple of other factors here that I didn't really have time to go into. One is that most of these comparisons are done using seeds that were created for conventional systems. In other words, these are seeds that are used to experiencing high input environments, and they're used to not having any competitors from weeds and that kind of thing. So you put these kinds of seeds into an organic environment, and they're not going to do very well. There's evidence that you can breed seeds for organic conditions that are going to outperform if they were placed in conventional systems, and vice versa. But that breeding really hasn't happened. Most of the seed breeding has been for conventional systems. So the comparison that shows this 14% yield gap is actually somewhat of a biased one to begin with.
Okay. For Malcolm, question about if you reduce population, you have fewer, perhaps wealthier people. You do something to reduce per capita consumption, carbon, water uses, et cetera, but because wealth correlates with consumption, you're still going to have some upward pressure on water use, consumption, carbon, et cetera. You have fewer but wealthier people. You're still...
No, I entirely agree. And it seems to be as people... If you look at sort of human misery indexes, as income rises, the misery decreases. And then people get pretty happy and the income keeps on rising and it doesn't make them any happier. We don't have a condom to limit this consumption, unfortunately. Somebody better invent one.
Do you have a T-shirt that says something like... What does your T-shirt say?
It says, control global warming, use a condom.
Condoms for carbon, something, yeah, okay, all right, okay. Let's end it there. I think we have a 15-minute break. Let's give them, again, thanks for a fantastic presentation.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.